Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Babs Black, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon.
Hi, Babs.
I want to thank the speakers who have come before me. I was particularly impressed with Bill last night. Is he here? Of course not. I'm saying this mostly to make him feel bad, but it isn't often that I hear sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous speak so openly, particularly for a large gathering like this, and admit freely that quite often they think with an organ other than their brain. I also have some just enough medical knowledge, the sort that's not of any use to anybody. And I don't know if you realize this, but it seems to tie things together in my mind. It seems that what we come to know in the human male as a moment of passion requires an enormous amount of blood to be rushed to that particular organ. Where do you think the blood comes from? Not the Red Cross. It rushes from their brain to their you-know-what. Now, I must have known that ever since I was a young child. At least I sensed it. So I want to thank Bill for being so honest. And I also want to thank him for helping me to understand, not necessarily that, but helping me understand what this disease is capable of. And even more glorious, what recovery can be. I watched his wife last night at dinner and his kids. And I have the occasion often to meet people in this kind of a circumstance. The kind of showcase families we have, you know the kind. He talks around a lot, and she goes with him. Little kids are in the back seat of the car. And oftentimes when I'm around them, other people aren't. And I see the sickness is still there. They may be not drinking, but what they have is not what sobriety offers. So, for this weekend that I'm here, I would hope I do not hear one sober member of AA chew out their spouse or put them down. And I would hope I would not hear one active member of the Al-Anon Fellowship make a joke at their alcoholic's expense, because that's not what we're all about. We got sick together, and it would seem to me only reasonable that we should recover together. And with that in mind, I want to thank the AAs, who are the big wheels for this thing, for allowing us to have a meeting, for allowing us to participate in this roundup. Kay has been in touch with me for some time. I accused her of not. And I've already made this amendment, but then she's got such a mouth on her that I probably should make it publicly. I was talking to Gracie last week, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to Missoula. I haven't heard anything from him, but I've got the ticket, so. And Grace said, well, you better make sure that they're expecting you. Well, surely they're expecting me. I mean, I've got it written right down here in the book. And she said, well, you ought to call them. So with that kind of a mindset, I called, and Kay answered, and I said, why the hell haven't you written me? Or, I mean, I expected some sort of communication. And there was a long silence, and then she said, I did write you. I sent you a program, and I sent you a note, and I sent you a bunch of brochures about white water rafting. And if I could, I would have just cut the phone conversation right there, you know, and sworn it wasn't me. But it had been someone imitating me because she's right. She did do all that stuff. She did do all that stuff. I have felt, ever since I got to the airport, I felt special. I'll tell you, that's one of the best parts of doing this deal. If you ever get a chance to do it, do it. Because, see, the truth is, the committee's full of people who know they could do a better job at it than you can, but they don't want to. They just don't want to, and if you don't show one of them's going to have to. So it's almost like the second coming. You get out the plane, they say, oh, my God, there she is. My prayers are answered. And I know what's behind that, but nonetheless, it really feels good. I think this hotel is terrific. I think the food's great. I think the people that work here are marvelous. I cannot believe that there are three-way bulbs in the three-way lamps. I mean, you live high off the hog in Montana. I've been known to take my own damn bulbs when I go. My bathtub doesn't leak. The toilet flushes. And the thermostat is actually wired into the air conditioning. See, we don't do that in Texas. We put a dummy thermostat on the wall so you feel better. But it's not connected to anything. So I'm really glad to be here. I told you that I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon, and some days I'm grateful, and some days I'm recovering, and some days I'm not either one. This has not been a simple, easy journey for me. Although any idiot can look at the things we put on the walls of our meeting rooms and see what a simple program this is. Any fool ought to be able to do it. And I came within a hair's breadth of leaving more times than I care to tell you. Before my miracle happened, I watched it happen to everybody else. And damn it, it was my turn. And it didn't happen in my time frame. I've given up on you a lot. There's a real blessing at the first group I ever went into. Members of AA used to come up and say to me, Babs, what do you think of old George there? George would have been 2 days sober. And I had this uncanny ability to look at George and predict whether or not he would make it. And if I said he won't be sober by Monday, you better believe George is, as we speak, still sober this day. And if I said, isn't he precious and cute? He was going to be drunk before he left the meeting. I have an almost spotless record. I wish I could tell you that the first alcoholic I ever knew was the one I married. I think that makes us a little swifter somehow, don't you? Now, Shemaine, she has more knowledge and information at her tender age than I had when I was 35. I didn't understand the repetition of this thing. I didn't know why I found him so exciting. I didn't know why the Eagle Scouts that I was introduced to put me to sleep before I ever got. I mean, nothing seems more pointless to me than to spend time with people about whom you don't have anything to complain. Why would you do that? You might as well just stay home and read a book. Because for as long as I could remember, I'd been bitching. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, you do what you're comfortable with, and I was comfortable with that. That explained why I was never the Virgin Mary in the Christmas pageant. No, I mean, if you knew the background, the nuns resented my mother always showing up with a different husband every time we had an open house. And they took it out on me because they couldn't get to her. Of course, the fact that I had breasts in the third grade didn't play anything. And I'd also learned how to cuss like a sailor if I could get your immediate attention. And, oh, I was a favorite there. I almost closed that school. I remember we had a statue of St. Teresa that was in an alcove. She had on a lovely white dress. She looked about 12, 13. Angelic face. The usual statue of St. Teresa holding a rosary. And it occurred to me that there was something lacking. St. Teresa was not what we call anatomically correct. And this was in the early days of ballpoint pens. And I just took it upon myself to kind of adorn her statue. A nipple here or there. A little dense pubic hair. She was Italian after all. And one of those dirty little schoolers I went to school with ratted to this great big man. And it was then I became aware that you cannot remove ballpoint pens from priceless Italian statuary. And my mother had to pay to have the whole thing redone. They probably sent it back to Rome. I don't know what they did. I come to you from Dallas, but you can probably tell that I really wasn't quite born and reared there. My native state is Illinois, and I was born and raised there, as was my mother. We were born both in the same small town. All of my teachers in school had taught my mother. That, I suppose, could work to your advantage. It never did to mine. My mother was apparently the bright and shining star. She was every teacher's favorite pupil. She was going to go on in bigger and better things. She had so much potential. And then I came along. I heard early on that I was found inside a cabbage field, and I wish they'd never told me the awful truth, because I labored under that delusion for some time until another neighborhood kid told me where I came from, and it turned out he was right. I was born to my mother before she was 18. And she and my father, during the Depression, I was born in 33, in a small railroad town in northwestern Illinois where there were no jobs. And they tried to make a go of it. They tried to do the right thing. With no money, no maturity. I mean, they didn't have a prayer, let's be honest. They didn't have a prayer. And before I was a year old, they divorced. And once I found out what divorce was, I was certain that the reason they divorced was because I was there. It never occurred to me it was the reason they married is because I was there, but then. And I was so obsessed with bringing these two star-crossed lovers. My mother would not even allow his name to be mentioned in her presence. But I knew down deep she pined for him. And so when I graduated from high school in that little town, for the first time ever, we had assigned seating. And I was given 10 tickets. And I seated in my mother and my father next to each other and waited for the spark. And I was not disappointed. She was quite forthright about her opinion of him. And she walked out. Now, if you had told me that I was a hopeless romantic, I was not. I was practical. I had been raised by my mother's older sister and her husband in that little town. And I had such a family that, in the beginning, my grandparents raised me. My mom left to find her free fortune, and I lived with my grandparents. And I know some of you were not that fortunate. And for most of you, it's just too damn late. If you've missed that boat, you won't ever get another chance. But I will tell you my experiences. It's just terrific to be raised by grandparents. Because they don't have any investment in you, you see. They don't have anything to prove. They love you just because you're there. My grandfather bought me a drum when I was 3. And I became a drum virtuoso. And my grandmother would take me around to the neighbors and bring your drum, Barbara. And the neighbor would say, "Oh, really, Svea, she doesn't have to." And my grandmother would say, "Oh, no, she enjoys it." Barbara, play God Bless America for me. And I'd get pumped up and then I'd play it. That's how I played the drum. Each note got a little beep from my drumstick. And my grandmother thought I was musically talented. There was talk of getting me a private tutor. I mean, if you had never been raised by grandparents, you missed it. You just missed it. If my grandmother walked in the kitchen and caught me red-handed, the first thing she'd say is, "Which one of you kids put Bob Rand's hand in that cookie jar?" Because, see, I was innocent. I was always innocent. And I wonder if each of us, as children of God, don't have the right to start out that way. Because I will tell you, in an alcoholic family, you don't start out that way. But damn, I did. I knew, my grandpa told me there wasn't anything I couldn't do. I sat on his knee and listened to Franklin Roosevelt on the radio. And he told me, "If you want to be like Franklin Roosevelt, sweetheart, you can." He meant the president. I thought he meant I could get polio. But I knew from them I could do anything. God had given me gifts that would allow me to do anything and be anything I wanted to be. One of the things I wanted to be was not somebody that lived in a house with two old people. My grandfather was fat and bald, and my grandmother's hair was white. I don't know if you've noticed, but grandparents start out kind of old. And I got so I was kind of ashamed of them. Nobody else had people that old hauling them around. But up on the hill in that little town lived my aunt and uncle, my mother's older sister. She was 14 years older. She married a spectacular fellow. Oh, God. He was the only dentist in town, and he was the mayor. Everybody called him Doc. He was president of the school board. I don't think he had an enemy. Small town boy who made good. And come home to share his riches with his roots. And I adored them. They had two little girls a little older than I. A white Samoyed named Teddy. And a black cat named Smokey Joe. They lived in a two-story house up there. We called that Snob's Knob up there. And out my bedroom window, when I got to go live with them, I could see the beautiful, majestic Mississippi River. I could see the bridge across. I could watch the trucks from Iowa and the family cars come over riding high, fill up with cases of booze, and go back with their bumpers dragging on the bridge. One day my prayer was answered, and I was allowed to go up there, and it was just as terrific as I knew it would be. My cousins, Jackie and Jill, and they too. Jackie and Jill never did say to me, "You know, I wish you'd never come live here," but surely they must have felt that way. They must have. I was not an easy child. And that's putting it mildly. But it didn't hurt that my uncle was also president of the school board. And so he got me out of many scrapes. I remember saying to a teacher, she must have been 50 years old, and I'm about, I don't know, sixth grade, I guess. And she said something that I took offense at. And I said, "You watch your mouth, by Monday morning you'll be selling shoes." And she backed down. At any rate, my life there was just terrific until I was, I don't know how old, when I became aware something was wrong. There was an undercurrent that I didn't understand. And the thing that was wrong was with my aunt. She was crying at the most inappropriate times. My uncle was seldom there for dinner. He would come later. And my aunt took to putting his dinner in the refrigerator. I would offer to put it in the oven where we could keep it warm, and she said, "No, we don't want it spoiled by our grandpa in the refrigerator." So the gravy would congeal into a big glob on top of the potatoes. And then my uncle would come home, and she would haul it out of the refrigerator and sit it in front of him, almost daring him to eat it. And he would, because if nothing else, alcoholics have guts. And he put that congealed food down him, and he always said the same thing. "Smells good, Mama." It had been in the refrigerator so long, there was no smell. And he would eat his dinner, and he would go to lay down on the couch to rest his eyes for 20 minutes, and in 20 minutes he would get up and say he had an appointment a nighttime appointment downtown. Some farmer had to come in to have his teeth done, and my uncle would be gone, and my aunt would cry. And I saw nothing incongruous in his behavior, but I could not bear to see her cry. I loved her with almost an obsession. She was the mother I never had, and I would have killed to keep her from crying, and she would never tell me what was wrong. Never tell me what was wrong. Eventually, I discovered what was wrong. He didn't have an appointment. Some years earlier, he had brought the moose to that little town. I don't know if you got the moose in Montana, do you? If you don't, you have the VFW or the Elks, or doesn't make any difference what you call it. It's an outfit of people who join because of their mutual interests. And they have a bar, most of them I've been in, just about as big as this room. And then they have a meeting room, about as big as this table. The Moose has a... Their big deal is an orphanage in Moose Heart, Indiana, that they run and support. I guess it's where the orphans of dead meese who have drunk themselves to death go out. But he was a head antler on the Moose. And, of course, you had to be a card-carrying member. So you didn't just drink with the riffraff in there. You know, you drank with your own kind. And my uncle was heading right into the Moose every night when he said he had an appointment. He'd run upstairs and he'd turn on his office lights, and they were conveniently located right below him. Coincidental, I'm sure, and he'd run into the Moose, and he'd stay there till 10 o'clock when they were getting ready to close, and they'd run up, turn off their office lights, and come home. And I knew the secret. I knew why she cried. And I offered to fix it for her. Seemed to me all we had to do was confront him. The hell do you think's going on, Doc? You're not working, you're drinking in there. And that's not right, and we don't like that, and it's going to stop. And then I knew what he'd say. Well, for heaven's sakes, I had no idea you'd take offense at that. Well, of course I will. Why didn't you say something before? And then he'd be home on time, and we'd have dinner together and probably play Monopoly at night. I don't know. It's going to be good, good. And I offered to take care of that for my aunt. I was about in the seventh grade. And she gave me one of my first lessons about alcoholism. Then she turned on me, called me an ungrateful child. How dare I suggest something like that about him? After all he'd done for me. Gave me a roof over my head and clothes on my back and food in my belly. And I would suggest such a thing about him. That was the first and last time I ever suggested it. My uncle died of chronic alcoholism about 3 months after I found this program. But of course, he lived a long and happy life, you know. He was 57. And no one ever suggested that Doc died young. He developed diabetes and couldn't stop drinking. And so they began carving him up, as often happens in stage 4 diabetes. They cut off both his legs, and we're going to have to do some more. When he gratefully died of what his partner called cardiac arrest, I remember it was the last argument I ever had in that little town. It was with the MD who had been his partner all those years, and he put cardiac arrest on the death certificate, and I said, put chronic alcoholism, for God's sake, can't anybody here get honest just once? And he said, I couldn't do that to that family. So his death certificate says cardiac arrest. I guess we all die of that, don't we? And so when you hear statistics about how many people this disease kills, I want you to know that that doctor is not the only one who thinks that way and who refuses to bring that last amount of shame onto the family. But before my uncle died, he was very much alive in my life, and I was getting so I really couldn't handle it. My two cousins had married and left, and it was just the three of us in that little house, and alcoholism is progressive, and it was getting worse. And I wanted out. I just wanted out. before every dream I'd ever had was hopelessly shattered. There weren't a lot of options open to me in 1951. If I were to stay in that little town and find a job, there's no reason why I couldn't live in their home. I could always get married. And the railroad still employed maybe 100 people there. And that would be my ambition. I would marry a brakeman and we'd live there the rest of our lives. I didn't know a brakeman that I was necessarily interested in. Or I could go off to college. And my mother had said she thought she could help me with that. And so I began sending out questionnaires and resumes all over the country, looking for a place that was far from home. I made a life-changing decision based on someone else's drinking. And we do that. That happens every minute of every day, all over this world. I would never in my wildest dreams have thought of the University of Texas as a bastion of higher learning. I mean, you just don't grow up in northwestern Illinois and say, I'm really going to knuckle under here, and maybe the University of Texas will accept me. I didn't even know they had a university in Texas, nor did I give a damn. But they sent me a letter back, and they were far away. And on that basis, and that basis alone, I accepted a deal from them so I wouldn't have to pay out-of-state tuition. And it was within my mother's and my price range. And so I found myself one sunny afternoon aboard a plane on the way to a town called Austin. My aunt and I had shopped very carefully for my college clothes, and I was excited. My life was starting anew now, and this was my second chance. Boy, there'd be no holding me back. I was particularly concerned about my campus debut. You know, I wanted them to realize that they had pretty much a celebrity on their hands. And I certainly had had more than sufficient education to outshine them. So we got into Carson Perry Scott, and that fateful day I had on my cashmere sweater set. Do you remember those? They're bringing those back. It was a little short-sleeved sweater. It was about four sizes too small, and your boobs just fought to get out of there. And then you had this matching cardigan that you threw casually over your shoulders. I had my 100% wool, fully lined, pleated, plaid skirt. And, of course, my matching cashmere knee socks. And all this was topped off with my little Basswegian loafers with the little tassel. I'm telling you, I was just precious. God, every shiny surface I passed, I had to stop. I even looked good from the back. It's just terrific. And then the plane landed in Austin, and I walked out. And it was 165 degrees, very straight. And by the time the cab got me to the dorm, my little sweater had shrunk almost all the way up. And my belly button, hadn't been there a couple weeks, and I was forced to go to a freshman reception. And I was far too sophisticated for that. I didn't understand the people. They walked slow, and they thought slow, and they talked slow. It was like living in molasses. I thought, oh, God, I'm never going to be able to adapt to this. I had this uncanny urge to just whip in their little tongues out of their mouth. I wanted to say, for God's sake, say it or shut up. And I had to go to this thing. And it was in a room about this, no, it was bigger than this. It was a gym, Gregory Gym. Why would you name your gym Gregory? Anyway, it was in Gregory Gym. And there was orange and white. That's their colors, orange and white. Can you beat that? Orange, why didn't they choose pink and turquoise? Anyway, orange and white, dripping all over. And it was just what I knew it would be. Over here, I was about, 100 girls. This was back in the days of the poodle skirts and the crinolines, little ballerina shoes. I mean, we covered it up so well, you'd have never found it if you were even looking for it. Those skirts stuck out like this. And they're all over there fixing their makeup that nobody's messed with. And over here's these guys. Now, this was 51, as I say. And they were a sorry looking lot. They all were looking at the floor, digging their toe into the wood, leaning up against the walls. There's music playing, nobody's dancing. They're not even talking to each other. They're doing whatever it is they do when they have their hands in their pockets. And I thought, this is a waste of time. This is like the sixth grade, for God's sake. I went up on the stage to get myself a glass of that awful punch they served. And I turned around, and it was only then that I was able to take kind of an instant census. Because no matter how dense these girls were, there were nine times as many guys over here. The Korean War was just beginning to wind down. And those that had put in their time were coming back, and they were coming to universities just like the University of Texas. They had spent their tour of duty over there in those womanless jungles. Every last one of them was horny. And I looked at those odds, and I thought, you know, Barbara, if you put your mind to it, you could probably adjust here. Well, I want you to know I almost adjusted myself right out of the place. Oh, my God. I spent four of the most glorious years of my life on the campus at the University of Texas, and I mean that literally. Oh, my. I discovered guys, and they discovered me. And that little medical thing I told you about earlier proved to be exactly true. If you really want to make them stupid, show them how the blood rushes. By the time I was winding down my academic career, I realized that some of the better ones had been picked off, and I began to really get serious now. Because I did not want to leave that campus without some sort of a commitment. I knew where I was headed after that. Everybody I was going to be working with would be divorced four times, 65, fat and bald. I would never again have a field like that to pick from. And I really didn't think my criteria was too narrow. First of all, I was terrified that my husband might divorce me, that I might not be up to snuff, you know, and he might leave me. And I was also afraid that I might find myself someday caught in alcoholism like my aunt had been. And so all I needed, really, was a Roman Catholic that knew how to drink. I didn't know that was a redundant requirement at the time. I mean, I started looking. I'm hanging out at the Newman Club all the time. Texas plays Notre Dame, and I'm looking over every one of the Notre Dame players. He knows whose names I could never pronounce. Looked damn good to me. And wouldn't you know, he was brought to me as the result of a blind date. And he was everything I could ever, ever hope for. First and foremost, he looked really good. And I'm sorry to tell you that's the kind of shallow person I was. But I knew that the better he looked, the better I looked. And I never had enough courage or character to date a real geek. I just couldn't bring myself to. And this guy looked good. And then there was a second thing. He was shy and ill at ease around other people. Well, you give me somebody like that to play with. It's just like Play-Doh in my hands. I mean, shy and ill at ease has never been one of my problems. They called me in the dorm and said my date was there to pick me up. I don't know how he ever got that message across. He must have had it written on a piece of paper. I went down. He's the only one standing there. I said, "Are you Clayton?" He goes. I said, "Well, I'm Babs." He said. And we just stood there. I said, "You're here to pick me up, is that right?" "I understand we're going to a fraternity party, is that?" He said. "You have a car?" "Well, maybe we ought to go get in the car and go to the fraternity." And I said, "Thank you, God, I can handle this one." Wow. I mean, I was in love before we ever got in this car. And off we went. Went to the fraternity house, and he did the same routine. But they were mixing drinks out in the kitchen in garbage cans. You know that, where they pour something in? I don't know how many of those he had. I don't live very many. But I watched a transformation take place that I'd never, ever seen before. I mean, if Stoley could have been there and photographed him, they would have sold more vodka. Because when I saw what happened to him, whatever alcoholic, praise and hopes will help him, will happen to him. I mean, this guy tripped over the flowers and the rug at that dorm, and he had a couple of belts or whatever that stuff was, and all of a sudden he is Fred Astaire. I mean, he is tripping the light flank. He is dancing with everything that holds still long, lampposts. God, he was terrific, and he's doing a good job. And he was funny. He was at ease. He had awe. And I said, I want that one. I really want that one. I haven't seen anything that comes anywhere near that. And I'm kind of running out of time. I mean, I was no young woman. I was, what, 20? Oh, yeah. I could feel my ovaries atrophying as I... I knew that menopause was right around the corner. If I was going to do this deal, I'd better get with it. And besides, I saw in him such potential. Oh, God help us. You know, I never did find another living soul that saw that potential in him, but man, I did. He was a little rough around the edges, but all he needed was a little tender, loving care from a good, strong woman. And I was willing to do that. And so we were married. We went through all the pinned and engaged, you know, and all that stuff. But one fine day we were married at a nuptial mass in Houston, Texas. We were married by two priests, his priest and my priest, because we couldn't agree on a priest. See, now, I think to the normal human being, that might have suggested that we might be facing a few difficulties here. We moved into a small apartment, just he and I. We had never been just us. We were surrounded with all our friends, but once you get married, they kind of leave you alone. And I found he was dull as hell. Well, I mean, he just didn't have much to say. And I had far too much to say. And he wasn't interested. I got so I talked to the cat a lot. It wasn't working out. Not that, you know, I mean, I knew what husbands and wives were supposed to do, and I was willing to teach him. And he just would not listen. And then I discovered something. I kind of hate to tell this, but it's an honest program, I must tell you. We were talking about that blood rush, you know. Well, there is a time during that when they will agree to anything you ask. You have to time it just right now. But once they step over that invisible line, I'm telling you, there's no stopping them. And that's when I would elicit, that's when we had our chats. Because I indeed did have his attention. There's no question about that. And he would say, yes, yeah, oh, yes, yes, uh-huh. Of course, tomorrow he'd do whatever he wanted to do, and then I'd say he broke his promise. And that's how we... I'm trying to watch this time. Lord, am I divorced yet? Oh, God, it's 3 o'clock. I gotta get divorced. Drinking was not a problem early in our marriage. Money was. My husband drank a lot before we ever married. And when I questioned him about it, he explained that he was pretty much sexually frustrated. I don't know what kind of backed up, or I forget what he told me. But it made sense to me. And that once we were married and he was free to satisfy his sexual appetites, well, then I discovered that he drank even more because he was so damn happy that... And we began to argue about the money. Then I knew what we needed. We needed a child. That would bring some stability to this marriage, and any fool could see that. As I told you, we're Roman Catholic. I don't know why we hadn't had a dozen by then at the time. I mean, the church has it. You know, it's stacked against it. Let's get real. We're talking rhythm here with a pope that doesn't even dance.
I discovered that despite my ripe old age and my encroaching menopause, I was indeed able to get pregnant, and I did it time after time after time. We had a little girl, and things didn't change very much except for me. And then I knew that I needed another child to kind of get his attention, and we had another little girl, and my work was double. And we had another little girl, and then I knew we needed a boy. If you had a boy to bond with, you know, to fish and hunt with, of course he didn't fish and hunt, but it'd be different. And knocked up again, we moved to San Antonio. And this time it was different. I couldn't breathe, I couldn't sit, I couldn't lay. And finally, at about 4.5, 5 months, I went to see a doctor. He asked if he could take pictures, and then he said to me, "Well, Mrs. Black, I think there are 4, possibly only 3. And I said, "Babies?" And he said, "Yes." And the only way I can explain to you how I felt was I was pissed. I had 3 kids under 4. And I would take them to grocery stores. And this was back when we were talking about polluting the earth with overpopulation and, you know. And I would take them to grocery stores, and little blue-haired ladies with tight lips would say to me, "Are those all yours?" And I would say, "No, I run a daycare." I just didn't like the looks they gave me. And now they're coming in litters, and I don't think that's right. But as I was driving home, you know, Mother Nature does things to people like me, and I began to think about that. If he thought there were 4, there could be 5. And this was before the pill or anything, you know, no fertility drugs or anything. I mean, it's a big deal if you had 5 babies all at once. That meant the government would come and build a wing on your house, and the Gerber truck would come up and dump out all this baby food, and diaper people would give you all the kids to go to college. And we'd be on Life magazine, I knew that. The tour bus from Missoula, Montana would drive. These senior citizens want to see where the little quits live. So by the time I got home, I was really excited. I mean, I thought, well, how could we be so lucky? And I ran in the house. He was babysitting the kids. I could see him locked out there in the backyard. And I went in, and he had had just enough beer that he looked fuzzy to me. Now, I don't know if many alcoholics understand that. But invariably, there's now none or two that have had that experience. I seem to be able to tell how much he'd had to drink by how fuzzy he looked to me when I had had nothing. And I walked in, and he had just that little soft glow, you know, where he was not really feeling too much pain. And he said, well, what did the doctor say? And I said, we kind of both hoped it was a tumor. And I said, well, the doctor says there are 4, possibly only 3. And for the first time, but not the last, I saw instant sobriety. I never even heard of it. But I want you to know, I dropped that on him, and he just jerked like that. And he was as sober at that moment as he's ever been in his life. He looked me dead in the eye, and he said, "My God, Babs, what have you done to me now?" And I felt guilty, you know. And I'm sorry to tell you, I carried that guilt a good long time in Illinois. I had somehow gotten in the way of this boy's promising career. I don't know what the hell happened to his potential, but it sure didn't seem to be around anywhere. And we were struggling, both of us. We didn't have 4 or 3, we had 2. A little boy and a little girl. They weighed 1.5 and 2 pounds. And for many years, they were the smallest surviving babies born in Bexar County. If someone had said to me at that time, "Babs, why don't you ask God what his will is for you and ask him for the power to carry it out," I would say they were crazy. I knew what God's will was. God's will was that those babies survive. God's will was that we'd be able to bring them home. And that's what I prayed for. And a loving God answered our prayer. And 4.5, 5 months after they were born, they reached a birth weight sufficient that we were able to bring them home. And that meant we had 5 children. And the oldest had not yet reached her 5th birthday. My husband got a traveling job, and I discovered I didn't like kids very much. And
a period of my life that I have been gratefully relieved of memory of. I really don't know how those children ever survived those years, because I really wasn't there. I thought I was, but I wasn't. No matter where we lived, there was always some old bat lived down the corner somewhere. She had two little runny nose kids that bothered her. So she would say to them about 10 in the morning, "Go on up and play at the black. She won't even know you're there." And I didn't know they were there. Those years are truly, really a blur. I know that I did have a rather intimate emotional encounter with Captain Kangaroo. Well, he just looked damn good to me. I can simplify those years by saying that I was 37 years old before I had a bowel movement in a room by myself. And those of you women who have raised children, you know exactly what I mean. I have had other people's children sitting on my lap asking pertinent questions with their banky while I'm trying to get myself regular. And I suppose as we speak tonight, this afternoon, they're adults now, and I'm sure they're somewhere laying on a psychiatrist's couch trying to explain about this weird woman lived at the top of the hill, used to take him in the bathroom. God, I hope they don't have their memory returned so that they remember my name. My husband's alcoholism was such that he just kept getting better jobs and making more money. There's nothing more maddening to a purist like myself. I would argue with them every weekend. You can't work 2 days a week, buddy. I mean, they've got your number. They're going to throw your butt out of there. And then we're going to be on welfare. You can't keep this up. And one day he'd come home, he'd say, "You're right, I don't work for them anymore. I've gone across the hall and I'm making $10,000 a year more and I have a title." And that happened time after time after time, and it just infuriated me. I found that I had so many feelings during this damn vicious disease that I soon stopped feeling. Many of us do that. I just shut down. I couldn't handle it anymore, and I just shut down. And so when we finally came to Dallas in 1967, we had six children, best job he'd ever had. We had all those outside things that say you are a success. But our world was beginning to crumble. I'm being called up to school by my children's 12-year-old teachers. I don't think they were much older than that, who are suggesting perhaps there's something going on at home because my children are acting out at school. And I didn't go for anybody for help because I knew there was no help. I knew that life was a bitch. I knew that the best part of my life was over. I couldn't expect it to be good forever. I knew each day was going to be worse than the day before. And if it here lit the Pope, I was going to hang on till the bitter end. And I would make his life as miserable as mine was, if I could possibly do that. And that was the attitude I had when I came to my first Al-Anon meeting. For no apparent reason, on a Monday morning, my husband went to the Dallas Council on Alcoholism to talk to a fellow there about a friend of his that he was worried about. He was worried about the friend's drinking. Thank God the guy he got was a sober member of AA, and saw through him right away, and in no time at all had elicited a promise from him that he would go that night to an AA meeting. And then he called me and told me to bring him. And that's the only reason I did. Because he said, "If you don't take him, we'll never know whether or not he went." And I said, "I know the lion SOB, you're right. I'll take him, and I'll sit there the whole time too. And he won't leave either." And up we went, and in we went. He looked good, damn good. He always looked good. I had stopped looking good years before. Well, it gave him these funny ideas, you know. And I had dressed carefully. I had on my turquoise maternity belt pushers. I wasn't pregnant, but it's the only clothes I had anymore. And I had on that little white over blouse. I had my miraculous medal on the outside, hanging there like a headlight. I had my campfire girl and my Bluebeard leader's pins prominently displayed over here. I had on my turquoise Japanese thong sandals that matched my turquoise pedal pushers. I thought I looked good. And I didn't want to, you know, make the alcoholics feel bad. And I walked in, and an ugly woman came up to me. She was ugly, on October the 4th of 1970, and she's still ugly today. She said, "Pardon me, my dear, you're an alcoholic." And I pointed at him, and then I realized what she said. She might as well accuse me of being syphilitic. Couldn't she see? Of course I wasn't. My God. Had I not suffered enough? I want you to know I was physically escorted from my first AA meeting. They said it was closed. I didn't. What the hell do you mean closed? And then people like me couldn't be in there. Oh. They threw me in the next room, which happened to be where an Al-Anon meeting was. I'd never heard of Al-Anon. If I had, I wouldn't have come. And I sat and I listened to the man my husband had spent the morning with stand before that group of Al-Anons and talk seriously and honestly about his disease. And I could not have heard it except from the horse's mouth. For the first time, I heard and I believed that I was not responsible for what happened to my husband. It was not anything I had done or failed to do. Whether or not he had ever laid eyes on me, he would this day be an alcoholic. Oh, please, God, let that be true. Please, God, let it be true. I walked away from that meeting that night with just a smattering, not a lot, but a smattering of hope. That maybe what they were saying wasn't a bunch of bull. Maybe this thing really is a disease. Maybe neither of us has power over it. And maybe if he's able to do what they say, his life can change. And maybe if I can do what they say, my life can change. Early on, my children got involved in Alateen. And before I knew it, it was a rite of passage in our house. It was, those were glorious, terrific, wonderful years, and I would not trade them for anything. We've been coming to the program 8 years. My husband was sponsoring everything that had fly in their pants, and I'm sponsoring all the wives, and we are both terribly, terribly active. All of our kids now are old enough to be an Alateen, and I mean, it's a terrific life, and I know the marriage isn't going anywhere, but we'll fix that when we get around to it. There are more important things to do right now, and my husband announced to me that he believed he needed a divorce. And true to form, I said, "No, that's what you think you want, but that's not really what you want." But I just couldn't convince him. I mean, he was convinced that's really what he needed. And so he got one. And I will tell you, I've never been so frightened. I've never been so, "Oh God, I don't want to do that again. I really don't want to do that. I almost didn't make it." By then, there were 3 children still at home. His parents had come to live with us. He and I are both only children. And I kept saying, "You can't do this." And he said, "Yeah, I believe I can." My father-in-law, who was a retired attorney, he came downstairs when he found out what was going on. And he said, "Babs, I don't want to live in an apartment," because my husband went to the house sold yesterday. He said, "I want to live in an apartment." And I said, "Dad, I don't want to live in the back of the car." And he said, "Well, then, why don't you let me be your attorney?" And I said, "I don't know if you're a very good attorney or not, but the price is right. You got a deal." And my father-in-law was my attorney of record. Just by that simple act, he sealed my husband's fate. I mean, come on. Then we cleaned his clock. That's what we did. Well, I mean, how are you going to look at this thing? But I realized sometime later, I was talking to my sponsor. She said, "You know, Babs, you gave him a terrific gift." I said, "What was that?" "Well," she said, "you know, the guilt's going to get him sometime." See, because he started thinking with that other thing too, you know. And that one didn't last. I mean, I think 6 months or something, I don't know. And then she's gone, then he tried it again. That one wasn't so good. And then he tried. He's going to keep doing it until he got it right. And she's going to say to himself, "She stripped me of everything I ever owned." And that, I mean, that's a marvelous, marvelous way to get rid of guilt. Get angry at what they've done to you. So I gave him a marvelous gift. I must tell you that as we speak, as far as I know, he's still sober. In October, he will come up on 28 years of continuous sobriety. I don't know exactly what he does for a living. He lives out in the West somewhere. But he came when our latest grandchild was born. And I spent about 30 minutes with him. And much to my chagrin, I discovered at long last, at age 65, he has become what I always knew he could be. There is an ease about him and a peace about him.
that was never there before. The restlessness, the irritability, the discontent, those three damn horsemen that roar through our lives with this disease are gone. And I'm grateful. I am grateful for what has happened to him. If it meant that I am not to share his life, if I love him, then that's okay with me. A wise woman once said to me, to love somebody, Babs, is to want what's best for them, whether that best includes you or not. And yes, I believe today he has what's best for him. He left in 1978, and I never worked. I had the money. I had a diploma that hung over my washer. The big deal was I was a damn good Al-Anon, but I didn't think anyone was going to hire me on that basis. A nosy Al-Anon that worked at a hospital in Dallas wouldn't stay out of my business. You know, they're bad that way. And finally, to shut her up, I went over there to interview for the job I knew they did not have. And before that day was through, I came home with a job. I called my father-in-law. I said, Dad, I got a job. And he said, of course you did. I said, I'm working at Presbyterian Hospital. He said, you'll be running in a year. He was a neat guy. I miss him. He's dead now, but he lived with me till the day he died. And I miss him very much. After I'd been there a little while, Dad volunteered to work in the Radiation Oncology Outpatient Center. His wife had died, and he missed her terribly. And so he and I would go off to work 2 days a week. Dad to handle cancer patients and me to do whatever I was doing. And he and I had a deal. If either of us got lucky, we were going to leave our back porch light on. And I hate to admit it to you, but it's been, a lot of years, and I've still got the same original bulb in my back. This recovery that we're all caught up in is progressive too, you know. And I want to tell you that although your life will not be easy, and there will be a lot of things that happen to you as have happened to me, that I don't believe are fair, I don't think I deserve them, but with a loving God beside you, you can do anything. I have come to understand my own few limitations only since my husband left. And I am more pleased with who I am and what I can do than I think I ever would have been for. Our children are all fine and healthy, growing and have children of their own. And true to form, the girl twin, Christy, 3 weeks ago, married her own wet alcoholic. So here we go again. Why would God waste all this recovery on just an ordinary jerk? Our two sons are sober members of AA, and they've already been working on poor Doug. Bless his heart. His days are numbered. I want to thank you very much for being so kind and for making me feel so welcome here. If you ever find yourself down in Dallas, I'm in the Folk Hall. Give me a call. I'll take you to a meeting. It'll be a hell of a meeting. Afterwards, we'll go out to have a cup of coffee, split a piece of pie, and we'll talk and figure out how to fix your group. Thank you very much.